CBS's Mo Rocca, author of New York Times bestseller Mobituaries, comes an inspiring collection of stories that celebrates the triumphs of people who made their biggest marks later in life. Mo's new book is Rocktogenarians, and he joins us here on WGN. Mo, welcome back to the program.
Dave, it's great to be back with you.
You know, I really, honestly love your stories. Your books are such a compliment to your reporting.
Well, I'm happy to hear that because sometimes, you know, when you're in it, you don't really have a moment to sort of step back. But when I finish projects like this, then I do take a step back and I go, you know what? These are all sort of a piece, and that makes me happy that I see connections among all of them. And, one of which is I'm not ashamed to say old people are my jam. I like interviewing and writing about older people, accomplished older people than the young, new, hot thing. You know, that's just my thing.
You know, it's funny. My colleagues here and also management here at the radio station always knows as soon as somebody dies, they text me, did you interview so-and-so? And then 9 times out of 10, I did.
Yeah, I bet. Oh, that's great. Did you interview? I'll be jealous if the answer is yes. Did you ever interview Terry Garr?
I did not.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people didn't because she had not been well for a long time. But boy, that's a loss.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, even though people remember her from Young Frankenstein and Mr. Mom and so forth, I remember her on Letterman. Like it was nonstop. Yeah. She was a guest with him all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Great guest. Great, chemistry like that. It's so special, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you remarked that 80 has been the new 60 for about 20 years now. And in fact, there have always been late in life achievers, right, Mo?
Yeah. My co-author, John Greenberg, and I, when we got into this, it's not like we had a long list of people ready to go. It was really a learning experience for us. And that was one of the big discoveries, is that there have been people killing it, if you will, yeah. late in life for a long time. And I think it's only going to become more and more the case, you know, as life expectancy continues to grow and people stay healthier for longer. I mean, I don't think the culture and the way we live has really caught up with these advancements, and they're going to have to, especially also, not to get wonky with you, but with people having fewer children. I mean, the population, like it or not, is getting older. So we can't just sort of say, hey, we're putting you out to pasture, even though you're in great health at 65, 70, 75, or even 80. We need you.
Honestly, it's mostly my favorite conversations, and I think our listeners' favorite conversations, too, when you bring someone from such historic value, whether it's in entertainment or sports or politics, they have the best stories, and they've already lived an amazing life to share those stories, you know?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of the people in this book are having sort of second or really third lives that start in their 60s, 70s, or 80s. And I think, if you say, who's this book pitched to? Well, it's pitched to me because I'm 55. And so I think, I want proof that there's still time, you know, God willing, I stay healthy, you know, all of us, that you can have whole other lives and careers, you know, starting later in life.
Yeah, you know, we're only a couple years apart, and I sold my business a little over a year ago, a business I built with two different partners over 22 years, successful company, and now I'm ready for life 2.0 in my 50s. You know, like I'm divorced, yeah. I just got engaged, and I cannot wait to hit the ground running, and I want to break the stereotypes and thrive in the next couple of decades of my life and reboot all of it, you know?
I think one of the things, and I'm happy to draw on some examples here, but one of the things is that binds all the people profiles in this book together are that they lived in the moment and they weren't afraid. I think there's a lot of people that say, oh, once I make enough money, or once my kids are off to college, or, you know, once I feel like I've accomplished enough in this area, I'm going to pursue that other thing. And something doesn't allow us to do it. But, you know, you look at somebody like Estelle Getty, because you can't write a book like this and not include at least one golden girl. It would be against the law, I think. But she was 62 before she made her national television debut. Now, she had had this dream for a long time, but she was married early in life. She raised her two kids. She was doing any kind of theater she could in her spare time, but she never let go of the dream of really making it. And, you know, she was in her 50s when she went to see an off-off Broadway play by a then-unknown Harvey Fierstein. Wow. And she marched backstage afterwards without an introduction. She introduced herself and said, write me a part. And, you know, I love that. That's an ingredient that a lot of these people have, which is that they're not waiting to be discovered or led by the hand. She just really went for it.
Went after it,
And it's really inspiring.
Well, and you got into all this, and I want to back up a little bit with your first book on these subjects, Mobituaries, which also has a companion podcast, very much so because you were rewriting the send-offs, pretty much, of people that were not properly celebrated when they did pass on to another world. And a lot of it was, you know, because, you know, they passed on a day of another newsworthy event or when someone bigger died and they're under a shadow of some people that didn't even know that they passed away, you know?
Well, that was the case with Audrey Hepburn. And Audrey Hepburn obviously remains beloved, which is interesting because she was a big star, but there were bigger stars that are now, in comparison, forgotten. But she maintains a hold. But I had remembered that she died on the day that Bill Clinton was inaugurated for his first term in office. So she was pushed off the front page. And then I had the opportunity to interview Bill Clinton, former president, and I asked him, I said, were you aware that Audrey Hepburn died on the day of your inauguration? And he went, I didn't know. He said, I mean, I was kind of busy that day. But he said he was a huge fan of hers. And it was just an opportunity to do that podcast episode I was really happy with. We interviewed both of her sons about why they think she has really maintained this hold over the public imagination. That was an example, and there are other, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. died on the same day as Jim Henson. So, that was pretty wild. Yeah.
Conflict in that. And your fascination with all this came from your dad, right?
Yeah, my father loved obituaries, and my father was not a gloomy person at all. He was probably the most optimistic person I may ever know, but he loved the romance, the sort of sweep of a well-written obituary, because a good obituary is about somebody's life, not their death. So that book and that podcast were all about sort of celebrating people who didn't get the send-off I think that they deserved. And then with this new book with Rock Dictionarians, we've moved sort of from the dead to the pre-dead. Late life or, you know, did remarkable things.
Well, the older you get, you know, the less, first of all, the less you care about other people and what they think about you. But, you know, there's also this downside to old age. There's ageism out there, and that's not very positive. So this really celebrates those who have made great accomplishments and kind of inspires others, you know, as they turn into their last 20, 30 years of their life on this earth.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I don't want to let that point just sort of go by too quickly, because you're absolutely right that the older you get, the less you care about what other people think of you. That's something I learned when I did my cooking show called My Grandmother's Ravioli, where I went around the country learning to cook from grandmothers and grandfathers in their kitchens. It was really an opportunity for me to hear their life stories. But I did really come to appreciate that then, that these were people that at this stage in life really knew the three or four things that mattered to them in life. They were sort of unfettered otherwise. Their minds were uncluttered. And they also just didn't care as much. They weren't hung up on what other people thought. And that's really, really freeing and liberating.
We're talking to Mo Rock. His new book is Rocktogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. And there's more with Mo next after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. WGN. All right, we are talking to Mo Rock. His new book is Rocktogenarians. I have got a little Chicago connection here. You were taping a podcast some time ago here in Chicago at Millennium Park's Pritzker Pavilion, and you were talking to Chance the Rapper. And I want you to share that story because it's very interesting how it connects to all this.
Sure. This was for the public radio show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and our guest was Chance the Rapper in 2015, when he really had come on, was really sort of hitting the mainstream and was a very, very big deal. And we were doing it, as you point out, in Millennium Park. So it was a huge audience, not like our typical public radio audience, which is a little more sober. I mean, people were going bananas. And I was on the panel of this show with two other comics, and we were asking him questions. And, you know, so he was playing along. We were asking really sort of dopey questions, which we were proud to do. And I asked him what I thought was a question that would get an easy laugh, which is, I said, because I was 46 at the time, I said, I'm 46. Is it too old for me to become a rapper? And it got the middling laugh it deserved. And yeah. Then he looked at me dead serious without skipping a beat. And he said, I don't know. Some people might say it's too soon. That got a laugh and the conversation moved on. But honestly, Dave, I was sort of stopped dead in my tracks, because I think what I realized, all jokes and jokey questions come from a real place. And I think my question sort of revealed that, and I wouldn't have even admitted this to myself, that I thought of myself as kind of over the hill at 46, which is insane,
yeah,
which is crazy, which is, like, I would even say shameful. And I think his jokey response underneath it, what he was really saying was, you know, people develop at different paces, rates in their lives. And to be any kind of an artist, including a rapper, you need to have something to say. And you might be too young at 46. Now, the point of my telling the story is not that I could actually become a rapper. I don't, like, you know, I even write, like, my beatboxing is really subpar. So I'm not going to become a rapper in my 60s or 70s. But the lesson holds that, yeah, you know, to thinking of yourself as over the hill, especially when it comes to something creative, you know, is kind of sick and is wrong. And that's really what sort of set me on this idea of how ageism, which is real and it's really insidious, can really seep into our minds, and it's really pervasive.
I'm quoting you here. You have said, there's nothing sadder to me, I think, than people who feel like their stories are not worth telling and who die that way.
Yeah, I think we closed the book. There are sort of two different closings. There's a dedication at the very end to this point about my mother, who is now, I can't tell you her age, she'd kill me, but I'll just say she's 4 years shy of a landmark birthday with three digits in it, right?
Good for her.
And she wanted me to tell her story, which is really surprised me. And I'm glad that I did, because ended up doing that thing that we're all supposed to do, but most of us don't, which is sit down with our parents while we still have them and interview them about their lives. So this got me to do this, and I learned stuff about her. And I think in the process of her sort of telling me her story, she actually came to value it more, and that makes me happy. But Frank McCourt is also in this book, the great writer of Angela's Ashes, and he spent his life struggling with shame about the poverty he grew up in, and with being sort of paralyzed and unable to write down his story, even though he was a high school English teacher for a long time, even though his students loved his stories and said, you got to tell your story, even though he was friends with celebrated writers who went out drinking with him and said, you got to tell your story. Finally, his mother died, and he felt free. Everybody has their own sort of block. He felt free to write down his story, because he said ultimately that he would have died howling, that's a quote, if he hadn't told his story. And I really believe that. And when he did write it, he was 66 years old. Angela's Ashes sold 4 million copies worldwide. It was a global sensation. And he said afterwards, it took me 2 years and all of my life to tell this story. But we were both really moved by this story. And, you know, you think about what we all would have been denied had he not told his story. But it's not even so much about us. I just keep thinking he would have died howling had he not told his story. So
yeah,
I'm not saying that we all, you know, need to have a book contract to feel fulfilled. That's not going to happen. But I do think that people should recognize the value in their own story. And I know it happened. I write about it with my mother. I know that her, again, telling me her story and her own struggle. She's from Colombia, to come here and learn the language and, you know, make it, was kind of heroic. And she didn't recognize that for the longest time.
Maria Luisa Rocca, did she, because she knows what you do for a living, she knows how you write about people have passed on, she knew about this book. Do you think that is the reason why she said, you know what, I want to tell my story too. Mo, I'd like you to do this for me. Was that what it came from?
It's a great question. I'm not sure, and I'm not even sure I'd get it. She would be able to articulate it or would for me. She's really private, which I know sounds counterintuitive since she asked me to write about her. I think as she gets to this stage in life, there was an impulse
to be remembered.
Story to be remembered. And, you know, we write about Ebenezer Scrooge, obviously a fictional character. He was going to close the book before my mother surprised me and said, I want to be in the book. Yeah. And then she's the closer now.
Yeah.
But the whole point, I think the reason A Christmas Carol has a hold on us is twofold. I think it's A, because what it tells us is it's never too late to become a better person. But I think it may, even on a deeper level, be about the desire all of us have, though we may deny it, to be remembered.
Sure.
And it, by somebody. By somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. And documented, of course, in this book. You know, you do talk about people that they might have had their accomplishments in life, but the big one came at the end. But there's some of the people in this book were unknown before they broke through. You know, Laura Ingalls Wilder published her first Little House book at 65. And, you know, later in life, even further than that, you know, she had her struggles as well. But she's a perfect example who, again, at 65, made her name, and a name that we still talk about today.
Yeah, you know, look, I loved that TV series, and I loved the books. I don't know that I read all eight as a kid, but I certainly read, you know, more than a couple of them, and I loved them. And it's funny, my mother, who's from Colombia, these books have such a hold over people. They're so universal. They're not, you don't have to be from the Midwest or even American to appreciate them. My mother loved them. So and they're really big in Korea. I know that anecdotally. I did not realize how difficult her life had been after the Prairie years. And it was really hard. She and Al Manzo, since that Dean Butler's character from the series, that it's more pleasing to the ear to hear Almanzo, but it was apparently actually pronounced Almanzo, that they were very poor. They moved from state to state, oftentimes, you know, chased by creditors. They settled in the Ozarks of Missouri. Their daughter Rose herself, she became sort of a controversial figure later in life, but she had to go to school without shoes. She was mocked for her poverty. And Laura, her mother, began writing for an agricultural journal, really just to get by during the Depression. And during the Depression, as they became so poor, she began writing more sort of just to survive. And then her daughter told her, listen, you lived this epic life. You were there for the closing of the frontier, from the transition to pioneer living to small town living. You have to tell this story. And Laura said, you know, I don't know how to do this. And then Rose gave her the single best piece of advice, which is write as if you're writing in a diary, that you're just writing for yourself. And what came out were those Little House books. And what a gift to the world. And and the first one was when she was published when she was 65. And, you know, she died a wealthy woman, but more importantly, she told those great stories.
She did. Absolutely did. We're talking to Mo Rocca. His new book is Rocktogenarian's Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. And there's more with Mo next on 720 WGN. We're talking to Mo Rocca. His new book, Rocktogenarian's Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. Or get kicking off the holiday season, makes a great gift as well. You know, Colonel Sanders, an amazing story. He was 90 when he passed in 1980. He held a bunch of jobs, you know, a steam engine stoker, an insurance salesman, filling station operator, but it was chicken, and again, very late in life that took off for him.
Yeah, I mean, Colonel Sanders starts the book because even though it's a story that a lot of people know, it never gets old. And actually, funny thing, one of my brothers was reporting on global religion for the Wall Street Journal and was in Uganda and met a female pastor whose idol was, or maybe I should say whose hero, but it was Colonel Sanders, because it's such a universal story. And Colonel Sanders was living his life. He was doing fine. As you point out, he had very little formal education. One of his jobs had also been as a midwife. But he had this chicken and biscuits joint attached to a Shell gas station in the small town of Corbin, Kentucky. He was doing fine, but then in the 1950s, a highway came through, was built, you know, in a through Kentucky, bypassing the town. The bottom fell out of his business. He sold it at loss at auction. And then he faced a choice. He had $105 that he was living on in Social Security each month. Wow. He could have subsisted on it. He was 66. But instead, he got in his car with a pressure cooker and a bucket of the secret recipe of 11 herbs and spices. And he began driving town to town to town, cooking for people. They only paid him if they were satisfied with the meal. And within 8 years, he was the face of a Kentucky fried empire of over 800 stores worldwide. Yeah. I mean, it's a remarkable, remarkable story. And the image of him getting in that car and just driving forward is such a great image.
You know, you pair him with Clara Peller, who, you know, in my generation, I know who she was. Where's the beef? You know, put this woman on the map. She was in her 80s, passed away just a few years later of that famous Wendy spot. But again, very much like you're talking about our Golden Girl, is she found fame very late in life.
She found fame, but late in life. You know, that's a little bit of a Cinderella story because it's, you know, it's more of a it could happen to you and right in a great Chicago story. But Clara Peller, one of the things I love is that in her Wikipedia page, her birthplace is listed as Imperial Russia. That's how old she was.
Wow.
And so, but yeah, she was a manicurist, a divorced woman, you know, raising her kids, and she had this great gravelly voice. And it was a great advertising executive in Chicago who discovered her for a different ad at first. But one of the funny sort of happenstance things here is that for the Wendy's ad, the line was actually, "Where's all the beef?" But because of her emphysema, she couldn't get all the words out. So she could only get out, "Where's the beef?" And let's say, "Where's all the beef?" never would have landed in the same way.
No,
you know, but
no.
With that bark saying, "Where's the beef?" it just, you know, it just resonated. And that was a great year, 1984, for women under 5 feet tall, because Mary Lou Retton, you know, became a superstar that same year.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. And there's, by the way, there's dozens of stories in this book. It's Warren Buffett, Willie Nelson, Sophia Loren, Jack LaLanne. I mean, it's endless. But, you know, Jimmy Carter just turned 100, oldest president to live at the century mark. But his presidency was not his greatest achievement in his life. It really did come later.
It really did. And one of the things that's interesting about Jimmy Carter is, you know, you think about the longer people live, how that all-important first line of their obituary changes. And, you know, Jimmy Carter's first term has been reevaluated, but let's be real here. It's never going to be considered first tier, you know, like a FDR or a Teddy Roosevelt or, you know, or Lincoln. But his post-presidency has been remarkable. I mean, I mean, it's, you know, the how he's dedicated himself, not to sitting on corporate boards and making tons of money, but to giving back and you know, they're spending so much time in Africa, you know, raising awareness of different diseases and, you know, election monitoring. I mean, it's a remarkable, remarkable life. And, you know, we tell the story there of how Admiral Nimitz, who became a great mentor of his in the Navy, you know, had an interaction with him early on where Jimmy Carter was honest and said that he hadn't always done his best. And Admiral Nimitz barked at him and said, "Well, why not?" He eventually took him on. But it's fair to say that from then on, Jimmy Carter has always done his best.
He absolutely has. Absolutely has. You talk about third act, personal milestones, Carol Channing and Suzanne Plachet with Tom Poston, finding love later in life, ageless architects, including Frank Lloyd Wright, misspent old age. I love this one. Phil Spector, Rudy Giuliani, John Tyler. Yeah, there's a way that you could really screw up your legacy, isn't there?
Well, you know, first, do no harm, right? I think this was the area in which you think all you had to do was do nothing.
Yeah.
And we kept politicians out of it for the most part because politicians ruin everything. Which itself might be a controversial statement because everything, you know, regarding politics is now. But we did sort of touch on it a little bit here in the case of John Tyler, our 10th president, who had a decent legacy. you know, he sort of set the precedent for presidential succession when William Henry Harrison, our ninth president, died after 31 days. It really wasn't clear what would happen. The Constitution wasn't crystal clear, but, you know, democracy was stabilized because he took the reins and said, no, I'm not just going to be acting president. I am now the president. And that's worked out pretty well for us, you know, when presidents have died in office or in the case of Nixon have resigned. But then came the Civil War and he sided on the wrong side and actually ran and was elected to the Confederate Congress. He died before he could assume office, but the New York Times, I think rightly when he died, you know, called him a disgrace. And Rudy Giuliani too. I mean, I've lived in New York a long time and, you know, I think that his term as mayor have been viewed, there's a little revisionism going on, which I think is unfair. I think he was a really effective mayor. And I think, you know,
9/11. I mean, he was the face of morale.
No. I think he was great even before, in many ways, not in all ways, but in many ways before then. And as you point out with 9/11, but my goodness, I mean, since then, it's been interesting.
It's been interesting for sure.
Yeah.
Last one that I want to talk to you about: Founding Fathers of Comedy, Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, Norman Lear, and yes, talk to Carl Reiner at least a few times a year. Talk to Norman Lear. Talk to Mel Brooks once. I mean, they're absolutely iconic. But the person I wanted to bring up that isn't really focused on in the book is Dick Van Dyke, and he'll be 99 in December. And talk about a guy later in life who just keeps moving. Oldest Emmy winner this year with Purpose. And I've talked about this before, but about a couple months ago, I was in LA and I spoke at Bob Newhart's memorial, and Dick was there. Yeah. And Dick was there with his wife, Arlene. And we talked for a little bit and he introduced himself to my now fiance. And he said, you know, what's your name? I like meeting new friends because mine are dead. And it just said to me, you know, he has a sense of humor about it all, and he has the energy, he has the physical energy, and he doesn't want to go anywhere. He just wants to keep being Dick Van Dyke and doing great things, making people laugh. And I'm telling you, when people see him, they're just warmed in the heart, you know?
Well, I've had the great pleasure of interviewing him, not having the contact that you've had with him. He is, you know, funny, I mentioned Wait, Don't Tell Me, the public radio show earlier. He is my favorite guest of all time because he sang the lyrics to the Dick Van Dyke theme song, which he's done subsequently a bunch, but I think we were one of the first that he sang it for publicly, and it was really, boy, what a treat when he did that. You know, when people say laughter keeps you young, it sounds really cliched, but when somebody like Norman Lear or Dick Van Dyke tells you that, you got to take it seriously because they're responsible for a good chunk of what we as a culture have found funny over the last 50, 60 years. And when you mention that, what he said about making young friends, it reminds me of Rita Moreno, who's in the book and I'm friends with. And Rita told me that she was very introspective when I interviewed her for this book. And she said, you know, when she moved from her home to senior living, not assisted living, but sort of a senior living community, she said she became very depressed, but she realized she didn't know how to make friends. And so she had to relearn that.
Amazing.
It's what's kept her young. So those founding fathers of comedy, Mel Brooks, Norman Lear, and Carl Reiner, they're in the book as much for their late in life engagement with the world as they are for what they contributed to comedy. And I think that there's a real relationship. And these guys remained, one only Mel Brooks living, but through their 90s remained, and Norman into his early 100s, engaged. And that's really, really important.
Absolutely. Mo Rocca, his new book is Rocktogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. The holidays are right around the corner. Makes a great gift too. Love your books, and I always enjoy talking to you, Mo. Thanks for hanging out with us once again. I appreciate it.
This was great, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you, Mo. All right, news is next here on 720 WGN.